This Labor Day at Lowe's, shop member-only doorbuster deals for a limited time. Save $50 on an Ego string trimmer, now $169. Plus, get 50% off select Holland pavers. Not a rewards member? Sign up for free today. But hurry, Labor Day doorbuster deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 9/1 while supplies last. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome my colleague John Hardy of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, Eyes on Ukraine conflict and the Russian claims and the Russian battlefield and the battle space entirely, we begin with, because that is at issue always in negotiations. John, a very good evening to you. It has been said over these last weeks that the Kremlin is claiming territory it does not possess, claiming the Donbass entire, which means four provinces in Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson. I want to establish what it is that the Kremlin does possess and what not. My understanding is that Kherson and Zaporizhia are completely out of the question. If there's any Kremlin presence, I can't see it on the battlefield. Do they have a position in either of those provinces? Good evening to you, John.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me back on the show. So just a couple points of clarification. The Donbass refers to two regions in eastern Ukraine, Donetsk and Luhansk. Russia controls just about all of Luhansk and maybe about three quarters or so of Donetsk Oblast. The latter is where Russia has concentrated its main effort, especially around the small city of Pokrovsk and nearby Konstantinivka. In Zaporizhia and Kherson, these are two regions in southern Ukraine. Russia controls varying percentages of those, but it really has very little prospect of taking the rest. These areas are lower priorities for the Russian military, at least at the moment, especially Kherson, really just not a whole lot of attacks there. It's just kind of positional fighting. In Zaporizhia, you see a little more activity, but again, not a ton of Russian attacks there. As I said, in Donetsk Oblast is really where Russia is concentrating its main effort. I mentioned Pokrovsk, Konstantinivka, the nearby city of Toretsk, Chasiv Yar. Also a little bit to the southwest, the Russians are trying to advance northwest of Velika Novosilka and push into the Dnipropetrovsk region. They've started to do that. So they're kind of trying to push behind some of the Ukrainian forces in the eastern part of Zaporizhia and Dnipropetrovsk. Pokrovsk, I think it's worth dwelling on that, given that it's the Russian main effort. I think on last week's show, maybe the week before as well, we discussed the Russian kind of penetration or tactical breakthrough near Dobropilya, a small city maybe 20 or so kilometers north of Pokrovsk. The Ukrainians have managed to contain that, redeploying some of their more elite units to that salient. And actually, it appears, based on reports from the ground, they've cut off some of the Russian troops there and basically just contained the salient. So, you know, the Russians still advance there, but the kind of worst case scenarios were avoided, where Russia could have, you know, exploited that tactical breakthrough and perhaps even achieved an operational level breakthrough, something they have not been able to do despite holding the initiative since fall 2023. So the Russians, in short, are continuing to make these kind of incremental attritional gains, but aren't able to kind of capture large swaths of territory at once. Moving a little bit further north, the area around Siversk and Liman, the Russians have been making some gains there in recent weeks, trying to get back to that town of Liman in support of their objective to capture the rest of Donetsk Oblast, particularly the cities of Slovyansk and Kramatorsk. And then I think it's also worth noting the area around Kupiansk in northeastern Ukraine, where the Russians have, over some months established various bridgeheads across the Oskil River and are now trying to loop behind Kupiansk. And according to reports from Ukraine have started to penetrate that city from the northern side. And then I guess we should also mention the area near Sumy in northeastern Ukraine. Here, some months ago, the Russians had, after retaking Kursk, the territory Ukraine controlled in Kursk Oblast, it started pushing across the border into Sumy. The Ukrainians redeployed some forces there and have been pushing the Russians back. So that area seems pretty stable, if not to Ukraine's advantage.
What I hear is that Russia controls no single complete province. It certainly doesn't control the Donbass and doesn't control the connecting provinces to Crimea. Is that all correct? They've got pieces of everything, but no domination.
They control basically all of Luhansk, maybe like 99%. So they've essentially accomplished the goal. But I think Donetsk, as I said, is the one they're focusing on now, both in their military efforts and in their demands in the negotiations. Putin demands that Ukrainian forces withdraw from all of the rest of the Donbass, including Donetsk Oblast, as part of a peace deal. There are other demands as well. In the southern provinces, he is essentially offering a freeze along the current lines. So obviously Kyiv has quickly dismissed these demands. It's politically it would be basically suicide for Zelensky, and also they'd be sacrificing some pretty defensible terrain, and so kind of undermining their ability to withstand a potential future invasion. Although I think it's worth noting that the so-called kind of Fortress Donbass, Fortress Belt in Donetsk Oblast, these kind of defensive lines and cities of Kramatorsk, Slovyansk, Juzhkivka, what have you. The Russians, I think, in a follow-on invasion, probably wouldn't try to go at these head-on. They try to encircle them. Nevertheless, it's defensible terrain that Ukraine would be really foolish to give up willingly.
In the hypothetical of the battlefield being frozen by negotiations, does Ukraine hold the front line that is sustainable, or is it fragile here and there?
I think the Ukrainians, have really dug in across the front and established multiple layers of defensive lines. I think those will be useful in a potential future, like third follow-on war. Right now, with many of these like large fortifications and trenches, what have you, the Ukrainians actually are not fighting from those. They're fighting from more smaller, like positions that are concealed in tree lines. But that system of anti-tank obstacles, minefields, fortifications, etc., I think it is still useful.
And the penetration that is reported by the Russians, what are the tactics, John? Are they using drones and small teams, or are they using armored vehicles? How do they penetrate when they do?
So the Russians still occasionally use armored vehicles. That's gotten more and more rare. As time has gone on, they are typically attacking in very small units, sometimes down to just a few soldiers or even like one or two. And so they'll basically send them through very porous Ukrainian lines, and these Russian troops will try to basically go as far as they can, maybe a few kilometers, and then start entrenching, and then the Russians will try to accumulate additional forces. So what you kind of end up with is a front line that doesn't exactly look like a line. It's more like a big gray zone with like Russia and Ukraine positions sort of overlapping. Ukraine, they continue to struggle with a shortage of manpower. Also, the threat of Russian glide bombs, artillery, like Molniya, strike drones, FPVs, drone drop munitions, what have you, that kind of discourage Ukrainian infantry from sticking their heads up out of their positions. So often you have these Russian troops kind of going past Ukrainian positions without being engaged by infantry, relying more on those strike drones of various types to destroy the Russian attackers. Another thing worth mentioning is that in combination with this kind of adapted style of assaults, you have the Russians making some headway in like kind of improving their own employment of strike drones of various types. The Elite Rubicon Center is worth mentioning here. I think we've discussed them on previous podcasts. But that center comprises both combat detachments and like an analytical center. So they have kind of improved Russia's ability to both take down other Ukrainian drones, which are used for reconnaissance or dropping munitions, whatever, and also conducting strikes against targets. So especially logistics is something Rubicon did well in Kursk and is now bringing to other parts of the battlefield, kind of isolating pockets by exercising a degree of fire control over key roads, often like kind of leaving FPV drones typically are often fiber optic models that are immune to electronic warfare, leaving them on the sides of roads, kind of in standby mode, waiting for a vehicle to pass and then striking it.
The heavier equipment, the heavier weapons, the artillery, are there artillery duels, or have the drones removed that from the battlefield?
So, artillery remains important, despite the fact that you often see stats like drones of various types cause like the majority of casualties on both sides. I think that's true, but artillery still plays a role, including in poor weather, including as a way of kind of funneling forces into kill zones. So it's still important, even as strike drones of various types have taken on maybe pride of place for the Ukrainians.
Is there air cover, either rotary winged or fixed wing, over the battlefield? Does it stay away because of anti-air?
Yeah, you see both sides employing tactical and army aviation, especially the Russians. The Russians are dropping, 100 plus, 150, sometimes even up to like 200 glide bombs per day. That remains a challenge for Ukraine. You see the Russians employing army aviation and attack helicopters, both to kind of lob unguided rockets, which isn't very effective, but also to launch like ATGMs, including the LMR long-range ATGM, like usually against like in the latter case, usually against like fixed targets. So yeah, that still plays a role.
And is there active mining going on, or is that all done now?
No, absolutely. Both sides, mines are really, really important for both sides. I think especially for the Ukrainians, given that they're on the defensive, very often in placing those mines using UAS. And so for the Russians too, you have drones dropping mines like in the Ukrainian rear. And by the way, they've started using their Garand-2, which is the Russian version of the Iranian Shahed-136. Those drones carrying PTM-3 mines to remotely mine on roads in the Ukrainian rear. So that's just kind of one method the Russians are using for that remote mining.
Speaking of John Hardy, in detail, John is giving us a picture of a battlefield that has not moved profoundly for some time, with small weapons tactics that are augmented by drones and major weapon systems. We're going to turn to the other weaponeering. That would be talk, talk, talk. Jaw, jaw, jaw is what Churchill called it. NATO and the Russian Federation and Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor, visiting with John Hardy, my colleague of Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. We've started with the battlefield and the tactics and some of the weapon systems, but certainly a major weapon system is a negotiating table. Conversations these last weeks look to Mr. Trump leading a way to a table for bilateral, trilateral conversations. Since then, the foreign minister of Russia, Mr. Lavrov, has gone on American television rejecting a meeting, and at some time remarks rejecting Mr. Zelensky as a negotiator. This is all very discouraging to Mr. Trump, who said that they have maybe 2 or 3 weeks before he makes another decision. John, what is the contribution now of NATO? Is it adequate for air defense? I know that was a big priority.
Right. So since mid-July, your listeners may remember that Trump's announcement with the NATO Secretary General saying that NATO allies would pay for weapons for you pay the United States for weapons taken from U.S. stocks to give to Ukraine. That initiative has gotten off the ground with now a handful of $500 million packages funded by NATO allies, including for air defense. We have Germany committing to provide a couple more Patriot fire units to Ukraine, so that will be a big help. So I think that is a bright spot. On the last episode, last week, we discussed. We were recording right as President Trump was meeting with European leaders and Zelensky at the White House. I think that meeting was a good show of unity, kind of helped counter some of the tactical diplomatic gains the Russians made in their Alaska summit. One big kind of do out to come out of that meeting at the White House was President Trump giving a more firm commitment that the United States would play some role in European-led security guarantees for Ukraine. We have some reporting today out of the Financial Times giving a little more clarity about what's being discussed. So, reportedly there'll be some U.S. ISR, intelligence surveillance, reconnaissance support provided, command and control support, air defense assets as well. We'll see if we have U.S. aircraft actually operating in Ukraine, but that is a possibility. So that's been something the European this kind of more firm commitment has been something the Europeans have been looking for quite some time to give more confidence to countries considering contributing to this so-called reassurance force in Ukraine. So that's an important ongoing conversation. The other piece with the talks with the Russians has not been making much headway. Coming out of that White House meeting last week, Trump was touting a bilateral meeting between Putin and Zelensky that Putin supposedly had agreed to. The Kremlin has since thrown cold water on that, basically saying, we'll meet with Zelensky when we, have a more firm agenda. What that really means is we'll meet with Zelensky once Kyiv swallows our very maximalist demands. We've discussed the territorial aspect of those demands, but there are kind of a host of others, which I think to the Kremlin are more important related to Ukraine's neutrality, demilitarization, what have you, essentially designed to make Ukraine a vassal state to Moscow, which President Putin deems one of the root causes of the war.
In your measure, John, given all this incredible detail, is the Kremlin in a position to be satisfied with the battlefield as it is now if it's frozen by a ceasefire?
So the Russians are still well short of the minimal military objective they set, which is capturing the rest of the Donbas. That being said, I think for Putin, this war is not about gaining a little extra territory in eastern Ukraine. It's really about what I just alluded to, which what he calls the war's root causes.
Right.
In his mind, that means Ukraine's attempts to escape the Russian sphere of influence and his broader grievances about the post-Cold War order, NATO enlargement, et cetera, et cetera. He's been railing about this for decades now. And so that's really what I think ultimately matters to him. The territory is kind of second order in importance.
And
That
so,
being said, I think, the Russians, they are not only well short of achieving their territorial goals. I think, they just don't have the leverage, the military means to force Ukraine to accept these kind of draconian demands that Putin is insisting on. And I think Putin also overestimates President Trump's ability to kind of coerce Ukraine into accepting those demands. And right now, I think President Trump isn't terribly inclined to kind of force Ukraine. He said he'll allow Kyiv to he'll defer to Kyiv to decide matters of territory. I think that's the right approach. Hope it continues.
And so I just want to make sure, 30 seconds, Russia is not in position to accept the battlefield, the front lines as it is now. That's not enough for the Kremlin. Is that correct?
They're demanding much more territory than they, have been able to seize or
Right.
can seize. But I think ultimately what matters most to Putin is Ukraine, the broader question of Ukraine and kind of making Ukraine a vassal state. So I think there's some room for Russia to compromise on territory, but their other demands are, I think, equally
Right.
unacceptable to Ukraine, and so the Russians aren't going to be able to achieve those likely.
John Hardy, Details, Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. Thank you, John. I'm John Batchelor.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
This Labor Day, say goodbye to spills, stains, and overpriced furniture with WashableSofas.com, featuring Anabay, the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly pricing. Sofas start at just $6.99, making it the perfect time to upgrade your space. Anabay's pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and interchangeable slip covers are made with high-performance fabric built for real life. You'll love the cloud-like comfort of hypoallergenic, high-resilience foam that never needs fluffing, and a durable steel frame that stands the test of time. With modular pieces, you can rearrange anytime. It's a sofa that adapts to your life. Now through Labor Day, get up to 60% off site-wide at WashableSofas.com. Every order comes with a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping, no restocking fees, every penny back. Shop now at WashableSofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.